Shortly after the departure of the two ladies, Dr. Greysteel was sitting in one of the palazzo's chill marble rooms. He was comforting himself with a glass of brandy and trying to find the courage to go and look for Strange, when Frank entered the room and said something about a black tower.
What?
Said Dr. Greysteel. He was in no mood to be puzzling out Frank's eccentricities.
Come to the window and I will show you, sir.
Dr. Greysteel got up and went to the window. Something was standing in the center of Venice. It could best be described as a black tower of impossible vastness. The base of it seemed to cover several acres. It rose up out of the city into the sky, and the top of it could not be seen. From a distance, its color was uniformly black and its texture smooth. But there were moments when it seemed almost translucent, as if it were made of black smoke. One caught glimpses of buildings behind, or possibly even within it. It was the most mysterious thing Dr. Greysteel had ever seen.
Where can it have come from, Frank? And what has happened to the houses that were there before?
Before these or any other questions could be answered, there was a loud, official-sounding knock upon the door. Frank went to answer it. He returned a moment later with a small crowd of people, none of whom Dr. Greysteel had ever seen before. Two of them were priests, and there were three or four young men of military bearing who all wore brightly coloured uniforms decorated with an extravagant amount of gold lace and braid. The most handsome of the young men stepped forward. His uniform was the most splendid of all, and he had long yellow moustaches. He explained that he was Colonel Wenzel von Ottenfeldt, secretary to the Austrian governor of the city. He introduced his companions. The officers were Austrian like himself, but the priests were Venetian. And this in itself was enough to cause Dr. Greysteel some surprise. The Venetians hated the Austrians, and the two races were hardly ever seen in each other's company.
"You ask the doctor," said Colonel von Ottenfeldt. "The friend of the Hexenmeister."
Footnote 1. German for magician.
"Of the great Wellington."
Dr. Greysteel agreed that he was.
"Ach, Sir Doctor, we are beggars under your feet today."
Von Ottenfeldt put on a melancholy expression, which was much enhanced by his long, drooping moustaches. Dr. Greysteel said he was astonished to hear it.
"We come today, we ask your..."
Von Ottenfeldt frowned and snapped his fingers.
"Vermittlung, wir bitten im Ihre Vermittlung, wie kann man das sagen?"
There was some discussion how this word ought to be translated. One of the Italian priests suggested intercession.
Yes, agreed von Ottenfeldt eagerly. "We ask your intercession from us to the Hexenmeister of the Great Wellington. Sir Doctor, we esteem very much the Hexenmeister of the Great Wellington, but now the Hexenmeister of the Great Wellington has done something. What calamity! The people of Venice are afraid. Many must leave their houses and go away."
"Ah," said Dr. Greysteel knowingly. He thought for a moment, and comprehension dawned.
"Oh, you think Mr. Strange has something to do with this Black Tower?"
"No," declared von Ottenfeldt. "It is not the tower. It is the night. What calamity!"
"I beg your pardon," said Dr. Greysteel, and looked to Frank for help.
Frank shrugged. One of the priests, whose English was a little more robust, explained that when the sun had risen that morning, it had risen in every part of the city except one, the parish of Santa Maria Zobenigo, which was where Strange lived. There, night continued to reign.
"Why does the Hexenmeister of the Great Wellington this?" asked von Ottenfeldt.
"We do not know. We beg you go, Sir Doctor. Ask him, please, for the son to come back to Santa Maria Zobenigo. Ask him respectfully to do no more magic in Venice."
"Of course I will go," said Dr. Greysteel. "It is a most distressing situation. And though I am quite sure that Mr. Strange has not done this deliberately, that it will prove to be all a mistake, I will gladly help in any way I can."
"Ah," said the priest with the good English, anxiously, and put up his hand as if he feared that Dr. Greysteel would rush out to Santa Maria Zobenigo upon the instant.
"But you will take your servant, please. You will not go alone."
Snow was falling thickly. All of Venice's sad colours had become shades of grey and black. St. Mark's Piazza was a faint grey etching of itself, done on white paper. It was quite deserted. Dr. Greysteel and Frank stumped through the snow together. Dr. Greysteel carried a lantern, and Frank held a black umbrella over the doctor's head. Beyond the piazza rose up the black pillar of night. They passed beneath the arch of the atrio and between the silent houses. The darkness began halfway across a little bridge. It was the eeriest thing in the world to see how the flakes of snow, falling aslant, were sucked suddenly into it, as if it were a living thing that ate them up with greedy lips. They took one last look at the silent white city and stepped into the darkness. The alleys were deserted. The inhabitants of the parish had fled to relatives and friends in other parts of the city, but the cats of Venice, who are as contrary a set of creatures as the cats of any other city, had flocked to Santa Maria Zobinigo to dance and hunt and play in the endless night, which seemed to them a sort of high holiday. In the darkness, cats brushed past Dr. Greysteel and Frank, and several times Dr. Greysteel caught sight of glowing eyes watching him from a doorway. When they reached the house where Strange lodged, it was quiet. They knocked and called out, but no one came. Finding the door was unlocked, they pushed it open. The house was dark. They found the staircase and went up to Strange's room at the top of the house where he did magic. After all that had happened, they were rather expecting something remarkable, to find Strange in conversation with a demon or haunted by horrible apparitions. It was somewhat disconcerting that the scene which presented itself was so ordinary. The room looked as it had upon numerous occasions. It was lit by a generous number of candles, and an iron stove gave out a welcome heat. Strange was at the table, bending over his silver dish, with a pure white light radiating up into his face. He did not look up. A clock ticked quietly in the corner. Books, papers, and writing things were thickly scattered over every surface as usual. Strange passed the tip of his finger over the surface of the water, and struck it twice, very gently. Then he turned and wrote something in a book.
"Strange?" said Dr. Greysteel.
Strange glanced up. He did not look so frantic as he had the night before, but his eyes had the same haunted look. He regarded the doctor for a long moment without any sign of recognition.
"Greysteel," he murmured at last, "what are you doing here?"
"I've come to see how you are. I'm concerned about you."
Strange made no reply to this. He turned back to his silver dish and made a few gestures over it. But immediately he seemed dissatisfied with what he had done. He took a glass and poured some water into it. Then he took a tiny bottle and carefully tipped two drops of liquid into the glass. Dr. Greysteel watched him. There was no label upon the bottle. The liquid was amber-colored. It could have been anything. Strange observed Dr. Greysteel's eyes upon him.
"I suppose you are going to say I ought not to take this.
Well, you may spare yourself the trouble."
He drank it down in one draught.
"You will not say so when you know the reason."
"No, no,"
said Dr. Greysteel in his most placating tone, the one he employed for his most difficult patients.
"I assure you, I was going to say nothing of the kind. I only wish to know if you are in pain or ill. I thought last night that you were. Perhaps I can advise."
He stopped. He smelt something. It was quite overpowering. A dry, musty scent mixed with something rank and animal. And the curious thing was that he recognized it. Suddenly, he could smell the room where the old woman lived. The mad old woman with all the cats.
"My wife is alive," said Strange.
His voice was hoarse and thick.
"Ah, there. He did not know that."
Dr. Greysteel turned cold. If there was anything Strange could have said to alarm him even more, this was probably it.
"They told me she was dead," continued Strange. "They told me that they had buried her. I cannot believe I was so taken in. She was enchanted. She was stolen from me, and that is why I need this."
He waved the little bottle of amber-coloured liquid in the doctor's face. Dr. Greysteel and Frank took a step or two backwards. Frank muttered in the doctor's ear,
"All is well, sir. All is well. I shall not let him harm you. I have the measure of him. Do not fear."
"I cannot go back to the house," said Strange. "He has expelled me, and he will not let me go back. The trees will not let me pass. I have tried spells of disenchantment, but they do not work. They do not work."
"Have you been doing magic since last night?" asked Dr. Greysteel.
"What? Yes.
I'm very sorry to hear it. You should rest. I dare say you do not remember very much of last night."
"Ha!" exclaimed Strange with bitterest irony. "I shall never forget the smallest detail."
"Is that so? Is that so?"
said Dr. Greysteel in the same soothing tone.
"Well, I cannot conceal from you that your appearance alarmed me. You were not yourself. It was the consequence, I am sure, of overwork. Perhaps if I—"
"Forgive me, Dr. Greysteel, but as I have just explained, my wife is enchanted. She is a prisoner beneath the earth. Much as I would like to continue this conversation, I have far more pressing matters to attend to."
"Very well. Calm yourself. Our presence here distresses you. We will go away again and come back tomorrow. But before we go, I must say this. The governor sent a delegation to me this morning. He respectfully requests that you refrain from performing magic for the present."
"Not do magic?" Strange laughed, a cold, hard, humorless sound. "You ask me to stop now? Quite impossible. What did God make me a magician for, if not for this?"
He returned to his silver dish and began to draw signs in the air just above the surface of the water.
"Then at least free the parish from this unnatural night. Do that at least for me, for friendship's sake, for Flora's sake."
Strange paused in the middle of a gesture.
"What are you talking about? What unnatural night? What is unnatural about it?"
"Oh, for God's sake, Strange, it is almost noon."
For a moment Strange said nothing. He looked at the black window, at the darkness in the room, and finally at Dr. Greysteel.
"I had not the least idea," he whispered aghast. "Believe me, this is not my doing."
"Well, whose is it, then?"
Strange did not reply. He stared vacantly about the room. Dr. Greysteel feared it would only vex him to be questioned more about the darkness, and so he simply asked,
"Can you bring the daylight back?"
I do not know."
Dr. Greysteel told Strange that they would come again the next day, and he took the opportunity once more to recommend sleep as an excellent remedy. Strange was not listening. But just as Dr. Greysteel and Frank were leaving, he took hold of the doctor's arm and whispered,
"May I ask you something?"
Dr. Greysteel nodded.
"Are you not afraid that it will go out?"
"What will go out?"
asked Dr. Greysteel.
"The candle."
Strange gestured to Dr. Greysteel's forehead.
"The candle inside your head."
Outside, the darkness seemed eerier than ever. Dr. Greysteel and Frank made their way silently through the night streets. When they reached the daylight at the western extremity of St. Mark's Piazza, both breathed a great sigh of relief. Dr. Greysteel said,
"I am determined to say nothing to the governor about the overturn of his reason. God knows what the Austrians might do. They might send soldiers to arrest him, or worse. I shall simply say that he is unable to banish the knight just now, but that he means no harm to the city, for I am quite certain he does not, and that I am sure of persuading him to set matters right very soon."
The next day, when the sun rose, darkness still covered the parish of Santa Maria Zobenigo. At 8:30, Frank went out to buy milk and fish. The pretty, dark-haired peasant girl who sold milk from the milk barge in the San Lorenzo Canal liked Frank, and always had a word and a smile for him. This morning she handed him up the jug of milk and asked,
"Hai sentito che lo stregone inglese è pazzo?"
Have you heard that the English magician is mad? In the fish market by the Grand Canal, a fisherman sold Frank 3 mullet, but then almost neglected to take the money, because his attention was given to the argument he was conducting with his neighbour as to whether the English magician had gone mad because he was a magician, or because he was English. On the way home, two pale-faced nuns, scrubbing the marble steps of a church, wished Frank a good morning, and told him that they intended to say prayers for the poor, mad English magician. Then, just as he was almost at the house door, a white cat stepped out from under a gondola seat, sprang onto the quayside, and gave him a look. He waited for it to say something about Jonathan Strange, but it did not.
"How in God's name did this happen?" asked Dr. Greysteel, sitting up in bed. "Do you think Mr. Strange went out and spoke to someone?"
Frank did not know. Out he went again and made some inquiries. It seemed that Strange had not yet stirred from the room at the top of the house in Santa Maria Zabenigo. But Lord Byron, who was the one person in all the city who treated the appearance of Eternal Night as a sort of entertainment, had visited him at about 5 o'clock the previous evening, and had found him still doing magic, and raving about candles, pineapples, dances that went on for centuries, and dark woods that filled the streets of Venice. Byron had gone home and told his mistress, his landlord, and his valet, and as these were all sociable people, much given to spending their evenings among large groups of talkative friends, the number of people who knew by morning was quite remarkable.
"Oh, Lord Byron, oh, of course," cried Dr. Greysteel. "I forgot all about him. I must go and warn him to be discreet." "I think it's a little late for that, sir," said Frank.
Dr. Greysteel was obliged to admit the truth of this. Nevertheless, he felt he should like to consult someone, and who better than Strange's other friend? So that evening he dressed carefully and went in his gondola to the house of the Countess Albrizzi. The Countess was a clever Greek lady of mature years who had published some books upon sculpture, but her chief delight was to give conversazioni where all sorts of fashionable and learned people could meet each other. Strange had attended one or two, but until tonight, Dr. Greysteel had never troubled about them. He was shown to a large room on the Piano Nobile. It was richly decorated with marble floors, wonderful statues, and painted walls and ceilings. At one end of the room, the ladies sat in a semicircle around the Countess. The men stood at the other end. From the moment he entered the room, Dr. Greysteel felt the eyes of the other guests upon him. More than one person was pointing him out to his neighbor. There was little doubt that they were talking of Strange and the darkness. A small, handsome man was standing by the window. He had dark, curly hair and a full, soft, red mouth. It was a mouth which would have been striking upon a woman, but on a man it was simply extraordinary. With his small stature, carefully chosen clothes, and dark hair and eyes, he had a little of the look of Christopher Drawlight, but only if Drawlight had been fearfully clever. Dr. Greysteel went up to him directly and said,
"Lord Byron?"
The man turned to see who spoke. He did not look best pleased to be addressed by a dull, stout, middle-aged Englishman, yet he could not deny who he was.
"Yes? My name is Greysteel. I am a friend of Mr. Strange."
"Ah,"
said his lordship,
"the physician with a beautiful daughter."
Dr. Greysteel, in his turn, was not best pleased to hear his daughter spoken of in such terms by one of the most notorious rakes in Europe, and yet he could not deny that Flora was beautiful. Putting it aside for the moment, he said,
"I've been to see Strange. All my worst fears are confirmed. His reason is quite overturned."
"Oh, quite," agreed Byron.
"I was with him again a few hours ago, and could not get him to talk of anything but his dead wife, and how she is not really dead, but merely enchanted. And now he shrouds himself in darkness and works black magic. There is something rather admirable in all this, do you not agree?"
"Admirable," said the doctor sharply.
"Say pitiable, rather. But do you think he made the darkness? He told me quite plainly that he had not."
"But of course he made it," declared Byron.
"A black world to match his black spirits. Who would not blot out the sun sometimes? The difference is that when one is a magician, one can actually do it."
Dr. Greysteel considered this.
"You may be right," he conceded. "Perhaps he created the darkness and then forgot about it. I do not think he always remembers what he has said or done. I found that he retains very little impression of my earlier conversations with him."
"Ah, well, quite,"
said his lordship, as if there was nothing very surprising in this, and that he too would be glad to forget the doctor's conversation just as soon as he could.
Were you aware that he has written to his brother-in-law?
No, I did not know that.
He has instructed the fellow to come to Venice to see his dead sister.
Do you think he will come?
Asked Dr. Greysteel.
I have not the least idea.
Lord Byron's tone implied that it was somewhat presumptuous of Dr. Greysteel to expect the greatest poet of the age to interest himself in such matters. There was a moment or two of silence, and then he added in a more natural tone,
To learn the truth, I believe he will not come.
Strange showed me the letter. It was full of disjointed ramblings and reasonings that none but a madman, or a magician, could understand.
It is a very bitter thing, said Dr. Greysteel. Very bitter indeed. Only the day before yesterday we were walking with him. He was in such cheerful spirits. To have gone from complete sanity to complete madness in the space of one night, I cannot understand it. I wonder if there might not be some physical cause, some infection, perhaps.
Nonsense, declared Byron. The causes of his madness are purely metaphysical. They lie in the vast chasm between that which one is and that which one desires to become, between the soul and the flesh. Forgive me, Dr. Greysteel, but this is a matter of which I have experience. Of this I can speak with authority.
But, Dr. Greysteel frowned and paused to collect his thoughts, but the period of intense frustration appeared to be over. His work was going well.
All I can tell you is this. Before this peculiar obsession with his dead wife, he was full of quite another matter. John Usglass. You must have observed that. Now, I know very little of English magicians. They have always seemed to me a parcel of dull, dusty old men, except for John Usglass. He is quite another matter. The magician who tamed the Otherlanders. Footnote 2. A somewhat poetical name for fairies. The only magician to defeat death. The magician whom Lucifer himself was forced to treat as an equal. Now, whenever Strange compares himself to this sublime being, as he must from time to time, he sees himself for what he truly is, a plodding, earthbound mediocrity. All his achievements so praised up in the desolate little isle. Footnote 3. Lord Byron is speaking of Great Britain. Crumble to dust before him. That will bring on as fine a bout of despair as you could wish to see. This is to be mortal and seek the things beyond mortality. Lord Byron paused for a moment, as if committing the last remark to memory, in case he should want to put it in a poem. I myself was touched with something of the same melancholia when I was in the Swiss mountains in September. I wandered about, hearing avalanches every 5 minutes, as if God was bent upon my destruction. I was full of regrets and immortal longings. Several times I was sorely tempted to blow my brains out, and I would have done it too, but for the recollection of the pleasure it would give my mother-in-law. Lord Byron might shoot himself any day of the week for all that Dr. Greysteel cared, but Strange was another matter.
You think him capable of self-destruction? He asked anxiously.
Oh, certainly.
But what is to be done?
Done, echoed his lordship, slightly perplexed. Why would you want to do anything? Then, feeling that they had talked long enough about someone else, his lordship turned the conversation to himself. Upon the whole, I am glad that you and I have met, Dr. Greysteel. I brought a physician with me from England, but I was obliged to dismiss him at Geneva. Now I fear that my teeth are coming loose. Look. Footnote 4. See Byron's letter to Augusta Lee, October the 28th, 1816. Byron opened his mouth wide and displayed his teeth to Dr. Greysteel. Dr. Greysteel gently tugged on a large white tooth.
Well, they seem very sound and firm to me, he said.
Oh, do you think so? But not for long, I fear. I grow old. I wither. I can feel it. Byron sighed. Then, struck by a more cheerful thought, he added, You know, this crisis with Strange could not have come at a better time. I am, by chance, writing a poem about a magician who wrestles with the ineffable spirits who rule his destiny. Of course, as a model for my magician, Strange is far from perfect. He lacks the true heroic nature. For that I shall be obliged to
put in something of myself.
A lovely young Italian girl passed by. Baron tilted his head to a very odd angle, half closed his eyes, and composed his features to suggest that he was about to expire from chronic indigestion. Dr. Greysteel could only suppose that he was treating the young woman to the Byronic profile and the Byronic expression. Chapter 57. The Black Letters. Footnote 1. Strange's later Venetian letters, in particular his letters to Henry Woodhope, have been known by this name since their publication in London in January 1817. Lawyers and magical scholars will doubtless continue to argue over whether or not the publication was legal. Certainly Strange never gave his permission, and Henry Woodhope has always maintained that neither did he. Henry Woodhope also said that the published letters had been altered and added to, presumably by Henry Lascelles and Gilbert Norrell. In his The Life of Jonathan Strange, John Segundus published what he and Woodhope claimed were the originals. It is these versions which are reprinted here. December 1816. Jonathan Strange to the Reverend Henry Woodhope. Santa Maria Zabenigo, Venice, December 3rd, 1816.
My dear Henry, you must prepare yourself for wonderful news. I have seen Arabella. I have seen her and spoken to her. Is that not glorious? Is that not the best of all possible news? You will not believe me. You will not understand it. Be assured, it was not a dream. It was not drunkenness or madness or opium. Consider, you have only to accept that last Christmas at Clun, we were half enchanted, and all becomes believable. All becomes possible. It is ironic, is it not, that I, of all people, did not recognize magic when it wrapped itself about me. In my own defense, I may say that it was of a quite unexpected nature, and came from a quarter I could never have foreseen. Yet to my shame, other people were quicker-witted than me. John Hyde knew that something was wrong, and tried to warn me, but I did not listen to him. Even you, Henry, told me quite plainly that I was too taken up with my books, that I neglected my responsibilities, and my wife. I resented your advice, and on several occasions gave you a rude answer. I am sorry for it now, and humbly beg your pardon. Blame me as much as you want. You cannot think me half so much at fault as I think myself. But to come to the point of all this, I need you to come here to Venice. Arabella is in a place not very far distant from here, but she cannot leave it, and I cannot go there. At least, several lines expunged. My friends here in Venice are all well-meaning souls, but they plague me with questions. I have no servant, and there is something here which makes it hard for me to go about the city unobserved. Of this I shall say no more. My dear good Henry, please do not make difficulties. Come straight away to Venice. Your reward will be Arabella safe and well and restored to us. For what other reason has God made me the greatest magician of the age, if not for this? Your brother, S. Jonathan Strange to the Reverend Henry Woodhope. Santa Maria Zabenigo, Venice, December 6, 1816. My dear Henry, I have been somewhat troubled in my conscience since I wrote to you last. You know that I have never lied to you, but I confess that I have not told you enough for you to form an accurate opinion of how matters stand with Arabella at present. She is not dead, but 12 lines crossed out and indecipherable. Under the earth within the hill which they call the Brewer, alive yet not alive, not dead either, enchanted. It has been their habit since time immemorial to steal away Christian men and women and make servants of them, or force them, as in this case, to take part in their dreary pastimes, their dances, their feasts, their long empty celebrations of dust and nothingness. Among all the reproaches which I heap upon my own head, the bitterest by far is that I have betrayed her, she whom my first duty was to protect. Jonathan Strange to the Reverend Henry Woodhope, Santa Maria Zabenigo, Venice, December 15th, 1816. My dear Henry, it grieves me to tell you that I now have better grounds for the uneasiness I told you of in my last letter. Footnote 2.
This letter has never been found. It is probable that Strange never sent it. According to Lord Byron, letter to John Murray, December 31st, 1816, Strange would often write long letters to his friends and then destroy them. Strange confessed to Byron that he quickly became confused as to which he had and had not sent. I have done everything I can think of to break the bars of her black prison, but without success. There is no spell that I know of that can make the smallest dent in such ancient magic. For aught I know, there is no such spell in the whole English canon. Stories of magicians freeing captives from faery are few and far between. I cannot now recall a single one. Somewhere in one of his books, Martin Pale describes how fairies can grow tired of their human guests and expel them without warning from the brewer. The poor captives find themselves back home, but hundreds of years after they left it. Perhaps that is what will happen. Arabella will return to England long after you and I are dead. That thought freezes my blood. I cannot disguise from you that there is a black mood upon me. Time and I have quarreled. All hours are midnight now. I had a clock and a watch, but I destroyed them both. I could not bear the way they mocked me. I do not sleep. I cannot eat. I take wine and something else. Now at times I become a little wild. I shake and laugh and weep for a time. I cannot say what time. Perhaps an hour, perhaps a day. But enough of that. Madness is the key. I believe I am the first English magician to understand that. Norrell was right. He said we do not need fairies to help us. He said that madmen and fairies have much in common, but I did not understand the implications then, and neither did he. Henry, you cannot conceive of how desperately I need you here. Why do you not come? Are you ill? I have received no replies to my letters, but this may mean that you are already on the road to Venice, and this letter may perhaps never reach you.
Darkness, misery, and solitude, cried the gentleman in high glee. That is what I have inflicted upon him, and that is what he must suffer for the next 100 years. Ah, how cast down he is! I have won! I have won!
He clapped his hands, and his eyes glittered. In Strange's room in the parish of Santa Maria's Abenego, 3 candles were burning, one upon the desk, one upon the top of the little painted cupboard, and one in a wall sconce by the door. An observer of the scene might have supposed them to be the only lights in all the world. From Strange's window, nothing could be seen but night and silence. Strange, unshaven with red-rimmed eyes and wild hair, was doing magic. Stephen stared at him with mingled pity and horror.
And yet, he is not as solitary as I would like, remarked the gentleman in a displeased tone. There is someone with him.
There was indeed. A small, dark man in expensive clothes was leaning against the little painted cupboard, watching Strange with an appearance of great interest and enjoyment. From time to time, he would take out a little notebook and scribble in it.
That is Lord Byron, said Stephen.
And who is he?
A very wicked gentleman, sir. A poet.
He quarreled with his wife and seduced his sister.
Really? Perhaps I will kill him.
Oh, no, do not do that, sir.
True, his sins are very great, and he has been more or less driven out of England. But even so...
Oh, I do not care about his crimes against other people. I care about his crimes against me. He ought not to be here. Ah, Stephen, do not look so stricken. Why should you care what becomes of one wicked Englishman? I tell you what I will do. Because of the great love I bear you, I will not kill him now. He may have another 5 years of life. But at the end of that, he must die.
Footnote 3. Byron died of a chill 5 years later in Greece.
Thank you, sir, said Stephen gratefully. You are all generosity.
Suddenly Strange raised his head and cried out,
I know you are there. You can hide from me if you wish, but it is too late. I know you are there.
Who are you talking to? Byron asked him. Strange frowned.
I'm being watched. Spied upon. Are you indeed? And do you know by whom?
By a fairy and a butler.
A butler, eh?
said his lordship, laughing. Well, one may say what one likes about imps and goblins, but butlers are the worst of them.
What? Said Strange.
The gentleman with the thistledown hair was looking anxiously about the room.
Stephen, can you see my little box anywhere?
Little box, sir?
Yes, yes, you know what I mean. The little box containing dear Lady Pole's finger.
I do not see it, sir. But surely the little box does not matter any more, now that you have defeated the magician.
Ah, there it is, cried the gentleman. See, you have put your hand down upon the table and accidentally hidden it from my view.
Stephen moved his hand away. After a moment he said, You do not pick it up, sir. To this remark the gentleman made no reply. Instead he immediately returned to abusing the magician and glorying in his own victory. It is not his any more, thought Stephen, with a thrill of excitement. He may not take it. It belongs to the magician now. Perhaps the magician can use it somehow to free Lady Pole. Stephen watched and waited to see what the magician would do. But at the end of half an hour, he was forced to admit that the signs were scarcely hopeful. Strange strode about the room, muttering magic spells to himself and looking entirely deranged. Lord Byron questioned him about what he was doing, and the answers that Strange gave were wild and incomprehensible, though quite to the taste of Lord Byron. And as for the little box, Strange never once looked at it. For all that Stephen could tell, he had forgotten all about it. Chapter 58 Henry Woodhope Pays a Visit, December 1816
You've done quite right in coming to me, Mr. Woodhope. I've made a careful study of Mr. Strange's Venetian correspondence, and aside from the general horror of which you rightly speak, there is much in these letters which is hidden from the layman. I think I may say without vanity that at this moment I am the only man in England who is capable of understanding them.
It was twilight, 3 days before Christmas. In the library at Hanover Square, the candles and lamps had not yet been lit. It was that curious time of day when the sky is bright and full of colour, but all the streets are dim and shadowy. Upon the table there was a vase of flowers, but in the fading light it appeared to be a black vase of black flowers. Mr. Norrell sat by the window with Strange's letters in his hands. Lascelles sat by the fire, regarding Henry Woodhope coolly. I confess to having been in a condition of some distress ever since I first received these letters, said Henry Woodhope to Mr. Norrell. I have not known whom to turn to for help. To be truthful, I have no interest in magic. I have not followed the fashionable quarrels about the subject. But everyone says that you are England's greatest magician, and you were once Mr. Strange's tutor. I shall be very grateful to you, sir, for any advice you are able to give me. Mr. Norrell nodded.
You must not blame Mr. Strange, he said. The magical profession is a dangerous one. There is no other which lays a man so open to the perils of vanity. Politics and law are harmless in comparison. You should understand, Mr. Woodhope, that I tried very hard to keep him with me, to guide him. But his genius, which makes us all admire him, is the very thing that leads his reason astray. These letters show that he has strayed much further than I could ever have supposed.
Strayed? Then you do not believe this queer tale of my sister being alive?
Not a word of it, sir. Not a word of it. It is all his own unhappy imaginings.
Ah. Henry Woodhope sat silent for a moment, as if he were deciding upon the relative degrees of disappointment and relief that he felt. He said, And what of Mr. Strange's curious complaint that time has stopped? Can you make anything of this, sir?
Lascelles said, Oh, we understand from our correspondence in Italy that for some weeks Mr. Strange has been surrounded by perpetual darkness. Whether he has done this deliberately or whether it is a spell gone wrong, we do not know. There is also the possibility that he has offended some great power and that this is the result. Now, what is certain is that some action upon Mr. Strange's part has caused a disturbance in the natural order of things.
I see, said Henry Woodhope. Lascelles looked at him rather severely.
It is something which Mr. Norrell
has striven hard all his life to avoid.
Ah, said Henry.
He turned to Mr. Norrell.
But what should I do, sir? Ought I to go to him, as he begs me to?
Mr. Norrell sniffed.
The most important question is, I believe, how soon we may contrive to bring him back to England, where his friends may care for him and bring to a rapid end the delusions that beset him.
Perhaps if you were to write to him, sir.
Ah, no. I fear my little stock of influence with Mr. Strange all ran out some years ago. It was the war in Spain that did the mischief. Before he went to the peninsula, he was very content to stay with me and learn all I could teach him. But afterwards, Mr. Norrell sighed. No, we must rely upon you, Mr. Woodhope. You must make him come home, and since I suspect that your going to Venice could only prolong his stay in that city and persuade him that one person at least gives credit to his imaginings, then I most strongly urge you not to go.
Well, sir, I must confess that it makes me very glad to hear you say so. I shall certainly do as you advise. If you could pass me my letters, I shall trouble you no longer.
Mr. Woodhope, said Lascelles, do not be in such a hurry, I beg you. Our conversation is by no means concluded. Mr. Norrell has answered all your questions candidly and without reservation. Now you must return the favor.
Henry Woodhope frowned and looked puzzled.
Well, Mr. Norrell has relieved me of a great deal of anxiety. If there is any way in which I can serve Mr. Norrell,
then, of course, I shall be very happy. But I do not quite understand.
Perhaps I do not make myself clear, said Lascelles. I mean, of course, that Mr. Norrell requires your help so that he may help Mr. Strange. Is there anything else you can tell us of Mr. Strange's Italian tour? What was he like before he fell into this sad condition? Was he in good spirits?
No, said Henry indignantly, as though he thought some insult was implied in the question. My sister's death weighed very heavily on him. At least at first it did. At first he seemed very unhappy, but when he reached Genoa, everything changed. He paused. He writes no word of it now, but before his letters were full of praise for a young lady, one of the party he is travelling with, and I could not help suspecting that he was thinking of marrying again.
A second marriage, exclaimed Lascelles, and so soon after the death of your sister. Dear me, how very shocking, how very distressing for you.
Henry nodded unhappily. There was a little pause, and then Lascelles said,
I hope he gave no sign of this fondness for the society of other ladies before. I mean, when Mrs. Strange was alive. It would have caused her great unhappiness.
No, of course not, cried Henry.
Oh, I beg your pardon if I've offended you. I certainly meant no disrespect to your sister, a most charming woman. But such things are not uncommon, you know, particularly among men of a certain stamp of mind.
Lascelles reached over to the table where Strange's letters to Henry Woodhope lay. He poked at them with one finger until he found the one he wanted.
In this letter, he said, running his eye over it, Mr. Strange has written, Jeremy has told me that you did not do what I asked. But it is no matter. Jeremy has done it, and the outcome is exactly as I imagined.
Lascelles put down the letter and smiled pleasantly at Mr. Woodhope.
What did Mr. Strange ask you to do that you did not do? Who is Jeremy, and what was the outcome?
Mr. Strange asked me to exhume my sister's coffin. Henry looked down. But of course I would not. So Strange wrote to his servant, a man called Jeremy Johns, a very arrogant fellow.
And Johns exhumed the body?
Yes. He has a friend in Clun who is a gravedigger. They did it together. I can scarcely describe my feelings when I discovered what this person had done.
Yes, quite. But what did they discover?
What ought they to discover but my poor sister's corpse? However they chose to say, they did not. They chose to put about a ridiculous tale.
What did they say?
I do not repeat servants' tittle-tattle.
Oh, of course you do not. But Mr. Norrell desires that you put aside this excellent principle for a moment and speak openly and candidly,
as he has spoken to you. Henry bit his lip.
They said the coffin contained a log of black wood.
No body, said Lascelles.
No body, said Henry.
Lascelles looked at Mr. Norrell. Mr. Norrell looked down at his hands in his lap. But what has my sister's death to do with anything? Asked Henry with a frown. He turned to Mr. Norrell. I understood from what you said before that there was nothing extraordinary about my sister's death. I thought you said no magic had taken place.
Oh, upon the contrary, declared Lascelles. Certainly there was some magic taking place. There can be no doubt about that. The question is whose was it?
I beg your pardon? Asked Henry.
Of course, it is too deep for me, said Lascelles. It is a matter which only Mr. Norrell can deal with.
Henry looked in confusion from one to the other.
Who is with Strange now? Asked Lascelles. He has servants, I suppose.
No servants of his own. He is attended, I believe, by his landlord's servants. His friends in Venice are an English family. They seem a very odd set of people, very much addicted to travelling, the females as much as the gentlemen.
Name?
Greystone or Greyfield. I do not remember exactly.
And where are they from, these people called Greystone or Greyfield?
I do not know. I do not believe Strange ever told me. The gentleman was a ship's doctor, I believe, and his wife, who is dead, was French.
Lascelles nodded. The room was now so dim that Henry Woodhope could not see the faces of the other two men.
You look pale and tired, Mr. Woodhope, remarked Mr. Lascelles. Perhaps the London air does not agree with you.
I do not sleep very well. Since these letters began to arrive, I have dreamt of nothing but horrors.
Lascelles nodded.
Sometimes a man may know things in his heart that he will not whisper in the open air even to himself. You're very fond of Mr. Strange, are you not?
Henry Woodhope might perhaps be excused for looking a little puzzled at this, since he had not the slightest idea what Lascelles was talking about. But all he said was,
Thank you for your advice, Mr. Norrell. I will certainly do as you suggest, and now I wonder if I might take back my letters.
Ah, well, as to that, said Lascelles, Mr. Norrell wonders if he might borrow them for a time. He believes there is still much to learn from them.
Henry Woodhope looked as if he was about to protest, so Lascelles added in a somewhat reproachful tone,
He is only thinking of Mr. Strange. It is all for the good of Mr. Strange.
So Henry Woodhope left the letters in the possession of Mr. Norrell and Lascelles. When he was gone, Lascelles said,
Our next step must be to send someone to Venice.
Yes, indeed, agreed Mr. Norrell.
I should dearly love to know the truth of the matter.
Ah, yes, well,
Lascelles gave a short, contemptuous laugh.
Truth.
Mr. Norrell blinked his eyes rapidly at Lascelles, but Lascelles did not explain what he meant.
I do not know who we can send, continued Mr. Norrell. Italy is a very great distance. The journey takes almost 2 weeks, I understand. I could not spare Childermas for half so long.
Said Lascelles. I was not necessarily thinking of Childermas. Indeed, there are several arguments against sending Childermas. You yourself have often suspected him of Strangite sympathies. It appears to me highly undesirable that the two of them should be alone together in a foreign country where they can plot against us.
Now, I know whom we can send.
The next day, Lascelles' servants went out into various parts of London. Some of the places they visited were highly disreputable, like the slums and rookeries of St. Giles, Seven Dials and Saffron Hill. Others were grand and patrician, like Golden Square, St. James's and Mayfair. They gathered up a strange miscellany of persons. Tailors, glove-makers, hat-makers, cobblers, money-lenders, a great many of these, bailiffs, and sponging housekeepers. And they brought them all back to Lascelles' house in Bruton Street. When they were assembled in the kitchen, the master of the house having no intention of receiving such people in the drawing-room, Lascelles came down and paid each of them a sum of money on behalf of someone else. It was, he told them, with a cold smile, an act of charity. After all, if a man cannot be charitable at Christmas, when can he be? 3 days later, on St. Stephen's Day, the Duke of Wellington appeared suddenly in London. For the past year or so, His Grace had been living in Paris, where he was in charge of the Allied Army of Occupation. Indeed, it would scarcely be an exaggeration to say that at present the Duke of Wellington ruled France. Now, the question had arisen whether the Allied army ought to remain in France or go to its various homes, which was what the French wanted. All that day, the Duke was closeted with the Foreign Secretary, Lord Castlereagh, to discuss this important matter, and in the evening he dined with the ministers at a house in Grosvenor Square. And they had scarcely begun to eat when the conversation lapsed, a rare thing among so many politicians. The ministers seemed to be waiting for someone to say something. The Prime Minister, Lord Liverpool, cleared his throat a little nervously and said, "We do not think you will have heard, but it is reported from Italy that Strange has gone mad." The Duke paused for a moment with his spoon halfway to his mouth. He glanced around at them all and then continued eating his soup.
"You do not appear very much disturbed at the news," said Lord Liverpool.
His Grace dabbed at his lips with his napkin.
"No," he said, "I am not."
"Will you give us your reasons?"
asked Sir Walter Pole.
"Mr. Strange is eccentric," said the Duke. "He might seem mad to the people around him. I dare say they are not used to magicians."
The ministers did not appear to find this quite as convincing an argument as Wellington intended they should. They offered him examples of Strange's madness, his insistence that his wife was not dead, his curious belief that people had candles in their heads, and the even odder circumstance that it was no longer possible to transport pineapples into Venice.
"The watermen who carry fruit from the mainland to the city say that the pineapples fly out of their boats as if they'd been fired out of a cannon,"
said Lord Sidmouth, a small, dried-up-looking person.
"Of course, they carry other sorts of fruits as well, apples and pears and so on. None of these occasion the least disturbance. But several people have been injured by the flying pineapples. Why the magician should have taken such a dislike to this particular fruit, no one knows."
The Duke was not impressed.
"None of this proves anything. I assure you, he did much more eccentric things in the peninsula. But if he is indeed mad, then he has some reason for being so. If you will take my advice, gentlemen, you will not worry about it."
There was a short silence while the ministers puzzled this out.
"You mean to say he might have become mad deliberately?"
said one in an incredulous tone.
"Nothing is more likely," said the Duke.
"But why?" asked another.
"I have not the least idea. In the peninsula, we learnt not to question him. Sooner or later, it would become clear that all his incomprehensible and startling actions were part of his magic. Keep him to his task, but show no surprise at anything he does. That, my lords, is the way to manage a magician."
But you have not heard all yet," said the First Lord of the Admiralty eagerly. "There is worse. It is reported that he is surrounded by constant darkness. The natural order of things is overturned, and a whole parish of the city of Venice has been plunged into ceaseless night."
Lord Sidmouth declared,
"Even you, Your Grace, with all your partiality for this man, must admit that a shroud of eternal darkness does not bode well. Whatever the good this man has done for the country, we cannot pretend that a shroud of eternal darkness bodes well."
Lord Liverpool sighed.
"I am very sorry this has happened. One could always speak to Strange as if he were an ordinary person. I had hoped that he would interpret Norrell's actions for us. But now it seems we must first find someone to interpret Strange."
"We could ask Mr. Norrell," suggested Lord Sidmouth.
"I do not think we can expect an impartial judgment from that quarter," said Sir Walter Pole.
"So, what ought we to do?"
asked the First Lord of the Admiralty.
"We shall send a letter to the Austrians,"
said the Duke of Wellington with his customary decisiveness.
"A letter reminding them of the warm interest that the Prince Regent and the British government will always feel in Mr. Strange's welfare, reminding them of the great debt owed by all Europe to Mr. Strange's gallantry and magicianship during the late wars, reminding them of our great displeasure were we to learn that any harm had come to him."
"Ah," said Lord Liverpool, "but that is where you and I differ, Your Grace. It seems to me that if harm does come to Strange, it will not come from the Austrians. It is far more likely
to come from Strange himself. In the middle of January, a bookseller named Titus Watkins published a book called The Black Letters, which purported to be letters from Strange to Henry Woodhope. It was rumoured that Mr. Norrell had paid all the expenses of the edition. Henry Woodhope swore that he had never given his permission for the letters to be published. He also said that some of them had been changed. References to Norrell's dealings with Lady Pole had been removed, and other things had been put in, many of which seemed to suggest that Strange had murdered his wife by magic. At about the same time, one of Lord Byron's friends, a man called Scrope Davies, caused a sensation when he let it be known that he intended to prosecute Mr. Norrell upon Lord Byron's account for attempting to acquire Lord Byron's private correspondence by means of magic. Scrope Davies went to a lawyer in Lincoln's Inn and swore an affidavit in which he stated the following. He had recently received several letters from Byron, in which his lordship referred to the pillar of constant darkness which covered the parish of Mary Sabindigo in Venice, and to the madness of Jonathan Strange. Scrope Davies had placed the letters on his dressing table in his rooms in Jermyn Street, St. James's. One evening, he thought the 7th of January, he was dressing to go to his club. He had just picked up a hairbrush, when he happened to notice that the letters were skipping about like dry leaves caught in a breeze. But there was no breeze to account for the movement, and at first he was puzzled. He picked up the letters and saw that the handwriting on the pages was behaving strangely too. The penstrokes were coming unhitched from their moorings and lashing about like clotheslines in a high wind. It suddenly came to him that the letters must be under the influence of magic spells. He was a gambler by profession, and like all successful gamblers, he was quick-witted and cool-headed. He quickly placed the letters inside a Bible in the pages of St. Mark's Gospel. He told some friends afterwards that though he was entirely ignorant of magical theory, it had seemed to him that nothing was so likely to foil an unfriendly spell as Holy Writ. He was right. The letters remained in his possession and unaltered. It was a favourite joke afterwards in all the gentlemen's clubs that the most extraordinary aspect of the whole business was not that Mr. Norrell should have tried to acquire the letters, but that Scrope Davies, a notorious rake and drunk, should possess a Bible. Chapter 59. Lucrocutor, the Wolf of the Evening, January 1817. On a morning in the middle of January, Dr. Greysteel stepped out of his street door and stood a moment to straighten his gloves. Looking up, he happened to observe a small man who was sheltering from the wind in the doorway opposite. All doorways in Venice are picturesque, and sometimes the people who linger in them are too. This fellow was rather small, and despite his evident poverty, he seemed to possess a strong degree of foppishness. His clothes were exceedingly worn and shabby-looking, but he had tried to improve them by shining whatever could be shone and brushing what could not. He had whitened his old yellowing gloves with so much chalk that he had left little chalky fingerprints upon the door beside him. At first glance, he appeared to be wearing the proper equipment of a fop, namely a long watch chain, a bunch of watch seals, and a lorgnette. But a moment's further observation showed that he had no watch chain, only a gaudy gold ribbon, which he had carefully arranged to hang from a buttonhole. Likewise, his watch seals proved to be nothing of the sort. They were a bunch of tin hearts, crosses, and talismans of the Virgin, the sort that Italian peddlers sell for a franc or two. But it was his lorgnette which was best of all. All fops and dandies love lorgnettes. They employ them to stare quizzically at those less fashionable than themselves. Presumably this odd little man felt naked without one, and so he had hung a large kitchen spoon in its place. Dr. Greysteel took careful note of these eccentricities, so that he might amuse a friend with them. Then he remembered that his only friend in the city was Strange, and Strange no longer cared about such things. Suddenly, the little man left the doorway and came up to Dr. Greysteel. He put his head on one side and said in English,
"Are you a Dr. Greyfield?"
Dr. Greysteel was surprised to be addressed by him and did not immediately reply.
"You are Dr. Greyfield, the friend of the magician?"
Yes, said Dr. Greysteel, in a wondering tone. "But my name is Greysteel, sir, not Greyfield."
A thousand apologies, my dear doctor. Some stupid person has misinformed me of your name. I'm quite mortified. You are, I assure you, the last person in the world to whom I should wish to give offence. My respect for the medical profession is boundless, and now you stand there in all the dignity of poultices and pulse-taking, and you say to yourself, "Who is this odd creature that dares to address me in the street as if I were a common person?" Permit me to introduce myself. I come from London, from Mr. Strange's friends, who, when they heard how far his wits had become deranged, were thrown into such fits of anxiety that they took the liberty of dispatching me to come and find out how he is. "Hmm," said Dr. Graysteel. "Frankly, I could have wished them more anxious. I first wrote to them at the beginning of December, 6 weeks ago, sir. 6 weeks ago. Oh, quite. Very shocking, is it not? They are the idlest creatures in the world. They think of nothing but their own convenience. While you remain here in Venice, the magician's one true friend." He paused. "That is correct, is it not?" he asked in quite a different voice. "He has no friends but you."
"Well, there is Lord Byron," began Dr. Graysteel.
"Byron!" exclaimed the little man. "Really, dear me, mad and a friend of Lord Byron."
He sounded as if he did not know which was worse.
"Oh, my dear Mr. Graysteel, I have 1,000 questions to ask you. Is there somewhere you and I can talk privately?"
Dr. Graysteel's street door was just behind them, but his distaste for the little man was growing every moment. Anxious as he was to help Strange and Strange's friends, he had no wish to invite the fellow into his house. So he muttered something about his servant being in town on an errand just now. There was a little coffee-house a few streets away. Why did they not go there? The little man was all smiling acquiescence. They set off for the coffee-house. Their way lay by the side of a canal. The little man was upon Dr. Graysteel's right hand, closest to the water. He was talking, and Dr. Graysteel was looking around. The doctor's eyes happened to be directed towards the canal, and he saw how, without warning, a wave appeared. A single wave. This was odd enough in itself, but what followed was even more surprising. The wave rushed towards them and slopped over the stone rim of the canal, and as it did so, it changed shape. Watery fingers reached out towards the little man's foot as if they were trying to pull him in. The moment the water touched him, he leapt back with an oath, but he did not appear to notice that anything unusual had occurred, and Dr. Graysteel said nothing of what he had seen. The interior of the coffee-house was a welcome refuge from the chill, damp January air. It was warm and smoky, a little gloomy perhaps, but the gloom was a comfortable one. The brown-painted walls and ceiling were darkened with age and tobacco smoke, but they were also made cheerful by the glitter of wine bottles, the gleam of pewter tankards, and the sparkle of highly varnished pottery and gold-framed mirrors. A damp, indolent spaniel lay on the tiles in front of a stove. It shook its head and sneezed when the tip of Dr. Graysteel's cane accidentally brushed its ear.
"I ought to warn you," said Dr. Graysteel, after the waiter had brought coffee and brandy, "that there are all sorts of rumours circulating in the town concerning Mr. Strange. People say he has summoned witches and made a servant for himself out of fire. You will not be taken in by such nonsense, but it is well to be prepared. You will find him sadly changed. It would be foolish to pretend otherwise. But he is still the same at heart. All his excellent qualities, all his merits, are just what they always were. Of that I have no doubt."
"Indeed. But tell me, is it true he has eaten his shoes? Is it true that he has turned several people into glass and then thrown stones at them?"
"Eaten his shoes?" exclaimed Dr. Graysteel. "Who told you that?"
"Oh, several people. Mrs. Kendall Blair, Lord Pope, Sir Galahad Dennehy, the Miss Underhills."
The little man rattled off a long list of names of English, Irish, and Scottish ladies and gentlemen who were currently residing in Venice and the surrounding towns. Dr. Graysteel was astounded. Why would Strange's friends wish to consult with these people in preference to himself?
"But did you not hear what I just said? This is exactly the sort of foolish nonsense I'm talking about."
The little man laughed pleasantly.
"Patience, patience, my dear doctor. My brain is not so quick as yours.
While you've been sharpening yours up with anatomy and chemistry, mine has languished in idleness. He rattled on a while about how he had never applied himself to any regular course of study, and how his teachers had despaired of him, and how his talents did not lie in that direction at all. But Dr. Greysteel no longer troubled to listen to him. He was thinking. It occurred to him that a while ago the little man had begged to introduce himself, yet somehow he had neglected actually to do it. Dr. Greysteel was about to ask him his name when the little man asked a question that swept everything else from his mind. "You have a daughter, do you not?"
I beg your pardon?
The little man, apparently thinking Dr. Greysteel was deaf, repeated the question a little louder.
"Yes, I have, but," said Dr. Greysteel.
"And they say that you have sent her out of the city."
"They? Who are they? What has my daughter to do with anything?"
"Oh, only that they say she went immediately after the magician went mad. It seems to show that you are fearful of some harm coming to her."
"I suppose you got this from Mrs. Kendall Blair and so forth," said Dr. Greysteel. "They're nothing but a pack of fools."
"Oh, I dare say. But did you send your daughter away?"
Dr. Greysteel said nothing. The little man put his head first on one side and then on the other. He smiled the smile of someone who knows a secret and is preparing to astound the world with it.
"You know, of course," he said, "that Strange murdered his wife."
"What?" Dr. Greysteel was silent for a moment. A kind of laugh burst out of him.
"I do not believe it."
"Oh, but you must believe it,"
said the little man, leaning forward. His eyes glittered with excitement.
"It is what everybody knows. The lady's own brother, a most respectable man, a clergyman, a Mr. Woodhope, was there when the lady died and saw with his own eyes."
"What did he see?"
"All sorts of suspicious circumstances. The lady was bewitched. She was entirely enchanted and scarcely knew what she did from morning to night, and no one could explain it. It was all her husband's doing. Of course, he will try to use his magic to evade punishment. But Mr. Norrell, who is devoured, quite devoured with pity for the poor lady, will thwart him. Mr. Norrell is determined that Strange shall be brought to justice for his crimes."
Dr. Greysteel shook his head.
"Nothing you say shall make me believe this slander. Strange is an honourable man."
"Oh, quite. And yet the practice of magic has destroyed stronger minds than his. Magic in the wrong hands can lead to the annihilation of every good quality, the magnification of every bad one. He defied his master, the most patient, wise, noble, good—"
The little man, trailing adjectives, seemed no longer to remember what he meant to say. He was distracted by Dr. Greysteel's penetrating observation of him. Dr. Greysteel sniffed.
"It is a curious thing," he said slowly. "You say that you are sent by Mr. Strange's friends, yet you have neglected to tell me who these friends are. It is certainly a very particular sort of friend that voices it everywhere that a man is a murderer."
The little man said nothing.
"Was it Sir Walter Pole, perhaps?"
"No," said the little man in a considering tone. "Not Sir Walter."
"Mr. Strange's pupils, then. I have forgotten their names."
"Everybody always does. They are the most unmemorable men in the world."
"Was it them?"
"No."
"Mr. Norrell?"
The little man was silent.
"What is your name?" asked Dr. Greysteel.
The little man tipped his head one way and then another, but finding no way of avoiding such a direct question, he replied,
"Draw a light." "Oh, here's a pretty accuser. Yes, indeed, your word will carry a great deal of weight against an honest man, against the Duke of Wellington's own magician, Christopher Drawlight, famed throughout England as a liar, a thief, and a scoundrel."
Drawlight blushed and blinked at the doctor resentfully.
"It suits you to say so," he hissed. "Strange is a rich man, and you intended to marry your daughter to him. Where is the honour in that, my dear doctor? Where is the honour in that?"
Dr. Greysteel made a sound of mixed exasperation and anger. He rose from his seat.
"I shall visit every English family in the Veneto. I shall warn them not to speak to you. I'm going now. I wish you no good morning.
I take no leave of you. And so saying, he flung some coins upon the table and left. The last part of this exchange had been loud and angry. The waiters and coffee-house people looked curiously at Drawlight as he sat alone. He waited until there seemed little chance of meeting the doctor in the street, and then he too left the coffee-house. As he passed along the streets, the water in the canal stirred in the oddest way. Waves appeared and followed him, occasionally making little darts and forays at his feet, slopping over the brim of the canal. But he observed none of this. Dr. Greysteel was as good as his word. He paid visits to all the British families in the city and warned them not to speak to Drawlight. Drawlight did not care. He turned his attention to the servants, waiters, and gondolieri. He knew from experience that this class of person often knew a great deal more than the masters they served. And if they did not, why, he was able to rectify that situation by telling them something himself. Soon a great many people knew that Strange had murdered his wife, that he had tried to marry Miss Greysteel by force in the Cathedral of St. Mark, and had only been prevented by the arrival of a troop of Austrian soldiers, and that he had agreed with Lord Byron that they should hold their future wives and mistresses in common. Drawlight told any lie about Strange that occurred to him, but his powers of invention were not so great, and he was glad to seize upon any little half-rumour, any half-formed thought in the minds of his informers. A gondoliero introduced him to a draper's wife, Mariana Segati, Byron's mistress. Through an interpreter, Drawlight paid her a world of compliments, and told her scandalous secrets about great ladies in London, who, he assured her, were nowhere near as pretty as herself. She told him that, according to Lord Byron, Strange kept to his room drinking wine and brandy, and doing magic spells. None of this was very interesting, but she did tell Drawlight the little she knew about the magician in Lord Byron's poem, how he consorted with wicked spirits and defied the gods and all humankind. Drawlight conscientiously added these fictions to his edifice of lies. But of all the inhabitants of Venice, the one Drawlight desired most as a confidant was Frank. Dr. Greysteel's insults had rankled with him, and he had soon determined that the best revenge would be to make a traitor of his manservant. So he sent Frank a letter inviting him to a little wine shop in San Polo. Somewhat to his surprise, Frank agreed to come. At the appointed hour, Frank arrived. Drawlight ordered a jug of rough red wine and poured them both a tumblerful. "Frank," he began in a soft, wistful sort of voice, "I spoke to your master the other day, as I dare say you know. He seems a very stern sort of old fellow, not at all kind. I hope you're happy in your situation, Frank. I only mention it because a dear friend of mine, whose name is Lascelles, was saying only the other day how hard it is to find good servants in London, and if only someone would help him to a good manservant, he believed he would pay almost any money." "Oh," said Frank. "Do you think you might like to live in London, Frank?"
Frank drew circles on the table with some spilt wine in a considering sort of way.
"I might," he said. "Because," continued Drawlight eagerly, "if you were able to do me one or two little services, then I would be able to tell my friend of your helpfulness, and I'm sure he would say immediately that you were the man for him."
"What sort of services?" asked Frank.
"Oh, well, the first is the easiest thing in the world. Indeed, the moment I tell you what it is, you'll be eager to do it, even if there were no reward at all. You see, Frank, I fear something quite horrible will soon happen to your master and his daughter. The magician means them a world of harm. I tried to warn your master, but he's so stubborn he would not listen to me. I can scarcely sleep for thinking of it. I curse my stupidity that I could not explain myself better. But they trust you, Frank. You could drop a few hints, not to your master, but to his sister and daughter, about Strange's wickedness, and put them on their guard."
Then Drawlight explained about the murder of Arabella Strange, and the pact with Byron to hold their women in common. Frank nodded warily.
"We need to be on our guard against the magician," said Drawlight. "The others are all taken in by his lies and deceit, your master in particular. So it's vital that you and I gather up all the intelligence we can
so that we can reveal his wicked plans to the world. Now, tell me, Frank, is there anything you have observed, any word the magician let fall accidentally, anything at all that has excited your suspicions? Well, now that you mention it, said Frank, scratching his head, there is one thing. Really? I've not told anyone else about this, not even my master.
Excellent, smiled Drawlight.
Only, I cannot explain it very well. 'Tis easier to show you.
Oh, certainly. Where do we go?
Just come outside. You can see it from here.
So Frank and Drawlight went outside, and Drawlight looked about him. It was the most commonplace Venetian scene imaginable. There was a canal just before them, and on the other side a tawny-coloured church. A servant was plucking some pigeons in front of an open door. Their dirty feathers were scattered in a greyish-whitish circle in front of her. Everywhere was a jumble of buildings, statues, lines of washing and flower pots, and in the distance towered the sheer smooth face of the darkness. Well, perhaps not exactly here, admitted Frank. The buildings get in the way. Take a few steps forward, and you'll see it perfectly. Drawlight took a few steps forward.
Here? He asked, still looking about him. Yes, just there, said Frank.
And he kicked him into the canal. A resounding splash. Frank lingered a little longer to shout out some reflections upon Drawlight's moral character, calling him a lying, underhand scoundrel, a low dog, a venomous, cowardly blackguard, a snake and a swine. These remarks certainly relieved Frank's feelings, but they were rather lost upon Drawlight, who was by this time under the water and could not hear them.